Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, talking to reporters on Air Force One last month, Donald Trump said, quote, "Dakota Access takes it to the Pacific. Who do they compete with? Russia," close quote. Every word of that is nonsense, or as Politico graciously put it, it was not immediately clear what Trump meant. Given that the Dakota Access Pipeline goes nowhere near the Pacific, and oil is an international market. But while Trump is wrong out loud, corporate media are tacitly wrong in their evident belief, if coverage is guide, that the fight over the pipeline is over. We'll get an update on a struggle that's very much alive from Candy Mossett, organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Also on the show, the fact that Sinclair Broadcasting Group's bid to take over Tribune Media would create a behemoth with control of TV stations reaching 72% of the country's households might be the preeminent reason to oppose that deal, but it isn't the only one. We'll talk through the problems with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press. That's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Listeners may recall photographs of Native American people on horses facing masses of law enforcement in riot gear and tanks near Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. These powerful images seem to symbolize the fight of indigenous communities and others against a pipeline carrying fracked oil from the Bakken fields some 1,000 miles into Illinois, crossing the Missouri River that serves as a life source for the Standing Rock and others in the region. But fights have many fronts, some less visible than others. And as activists know, struggles don't end when media lose interest. The No Dapple fight may not be in your newsfeed anymore. That doesn't mean it's over. Far from it. Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She joins us now by phone from North Dakota. Welcome back to Counterspin, Candy Mossett.
Thank you. It's good to be back here.
Well, when we spoke with you last September, the resistance of the Standing Rock Sioux and other indigenous communities against the Dakota Access Pipeline had yet to make the broadcast nightly news. The struggle did get media attention after that, not always thoughtful attention, but some attention. But now again, after the pipeline's completion, it would appear that some of the press, anyway, think that the struggle at Standing Rock is not just over, but lost. What would you like people to understand about what's happening right now?
I really hope that people understand that what happened at Standing Rock, the importance of it can't be undermined in any way, shape, or form, because it was absolutely not a loss, nor is it over. We have a lot of things that are going on right now in reference to the Dakota Access Pipeline. We've been lifting up the struggles that have already occurred. There have been 3 leaks in that pipeline since it has begun operations. There were 2 in North Dakota and 1 that you might have heard of, a bigger one in South Dakota. We also have the North Dakota Public Service Commission, which was working with Dakota Access at the time. They have to, you know, put all these permits out and stuff when they do the whole process of having a pipeline. Well, they're actually preparing a case right now. One next Thursday, they are going to court against Dakota Access for at least 4 major violations that this company made. That was failure to notify the commission of their route changes. They had tree removal violations. They did separation of topsoil from subsoil, and those were violations. And they also had a violation of the company's spill prevention plan. So that case happening next week carries different fines and different things, negative things against the company that can come along with it. And this is at a time when we have a judge, Judge Boasberg, who ordered that, yes, they did mess up and there needs to be a further environmental review done. And he came up with that in June. So that was kind of another victory for us in the court case that still continues on. Now we're pushing this judge to decide to shut down the operations during that environmental review, which can take anywhere from 1 to 3 years to complete. They also do not have a plan for wastewater or for spills or anything like that. And so it's really important that people understand all of these processes are in play, and we're still looking at the possibility of shutting down the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Well, that's very exciting and not necessarily what I would guess from coverage, because one sort of got the sense that, well, Trump came in and green-lighted everything, and that's not the case. I mean, he may have tried to, but it
right.
sounds as though it hasn't won the day yet at all.
At all. In fact, he overstepped his authority in many regards to that particular signature that he put down, which is why it's coming out now. The reason why it's taking so long is because court processes operate that way. We don't expect the judge to make this decision until September for shutting down the pipeline while they do an environmental review. But as the Public Service Commission comes forward with their case here in North Dakota to show the environmental violations and different regulations that this company violated, the case is stronger and stronger to shut down this pipeline while this review actually happens. The thing is that it's all being done backwards because of this rushed, get it done, you know, get the pipeline in the ground nature. And it should call to attention to more people that laws were violated, laws were broken. Even though we're not in the camp anymore, we're still fighting for our constitutional rights to uphold laws.
Well, and speaking of that and of courts, more than 800 people were arrested during the mm-hmm. resistance. And of course, whatever else happens, those people are still personally, you know, very much in danger. What can we say about the situation of folks who are fighting for their right to have stood up against this?
It's kind of going on a case-by-case mm-hmm. basis right now, but we are seeing a lot of wins in the sector of all these people that are going to court. The thing is that it's costing folks money to go back and forth and to keep canceling court dates and making people go back and just really making people's lives miserable that were arrested simply for saying, we don't want this, we never did want it, water is life. So it is definitely a situation where the lawyers, the Water Protector Legal Collective, are working that we can actually drop all of the cases. And this is coming out from investigative reviews that are being done against Tiger Swan, against intelligence gathering sources here in North Dakota. A lot of behind the scenes information around just how crooked, I would say, mm-hmm. the system was when it came to the Standing Rock Water Protectors is all coming out now in investigations. So that's actually a really good thing for us. We're seeing a lot happening, and the Water Protector Legal Collective is a place that people can go. It's waterprotectorlegal.org. So you can actually donate to the cause, to the fight, to help out this 800 arrestees. You can look at their names. You can figure out who's all still fighting in the court and specifically donate to individuals. So it's a really good thing to continue to help this fight at Standing Rock, that it continues on. Like you said, the media might not be covering it because people aren't getting shot at, but we're very much still in the battle.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about Tiger Swan, because that has been one of the most alarming aspects, was Energy Transfer Partner, that's the DAPL parent company, hiring Tiger Swan, this group founded by retired members of a U.S. military counterterrorism unit, Delta Force. And the website The Intercept got some internal documents showing that Tiger Swan likened pipeline opponents to jihadists and described them as an ideologically driven insurgency with a strong religious component, on which we might have many notes, but I would say also another document said, quote, while we can expect to see the continued spread of the anti-DAPL diaspora, aggressive intelligence preparation of the battlefield and active coordination between intelligence and security elements are now a proven method of defeating pipeline insurgencies, close quote. Now, this is the group that's working hand in glove with law enforcement. So we see the state and private corporations acting as one, and then you have a situation where if you have a fight with a company, you're basically labeled a terrorist. And I know mm-hmm. that this isn't unique, but it just seems to me like whether DAPL is your fight or any other fight, you have to see the danger of what's happening there.
That's exactly right, and that is why Dakota Access Pipeline and this fight against it is really historic. We stood up against these things that are happening anyways. and are bringing it to the national attention and the national spotlight. Look, if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere to anybody. Privacy is, you know, being hacked into. People aren't allowed to exercise our constitutional rights in the United States that we say are so important. And we're showing that the industry has so much power and so much control. But at the same time, regardless of what Tiger Swan says in their own reports, we know that we're winning because they recently applied for a permit to operate in Louisiana. Now, a lot of people don't know that the Bayou Bridge Pipeline is a fight we're fighting as well, because it will connect to the Dakota Access Pipeline in Illinois. And that is how our country is moving this Bakken oil out of the country. We don't get any of the oil being extracted here. But that permit that Tiger Swan applied for in Louisiana was denied by the state of Louisiana because of their actions in North Dakota. Now, had we not been there and shown up and fought back against this company, they might still have free reign to go wherever. So you see, it's so important to look at the big picture and long term of these fights and these battles and not be afraid to deal with those, you know, short term consequences that are really horrific. It was really like bad for us. I was in the camp for 7 months fighting because of this oil that's coming from my own homeland. I'm like sitting here at my mom's house in Newtown right now and getting ready to do a toxic tour and getting ready to show people that the extraction still exists here in the Bakken for this oil that's going through Dakota Access. The fight doesn't end until we stop it at the source and keep these fossil fuel projects from happening. We say keep it in the ground, keep the oil in the ground. And that's what we're continuing to fight to do.
Well, and I would only add, in terms of media, keeping it in the ground is the scientific consensus. It's not a fringe idea. It's a scientific consensus that if we want to avoid, besides the immediate impacts even, which are catastrophic enough, the global impacts of not leaving fossil fuels in the ground are understood. And so I would hope that media coverage would always begin and end with that fact.
That's the goal. That's what we're working for. And we just need more and more people to wake up and have the will to say, you know what, I'm going to make a slight change in my life today. Because a lot of times the blame gets placed on the individuals. Well, you use this, you use that. This is how you live. We have to really focus on placing the blame where it squarely belongs, which is on the industry and the corporations that are making products that they don't give us any other choices. Why is it that in the United States of America, we don't have an entire fleet of only solar-powered plug-in hybrid vehicles? Why are gas guzzlers even still made? It's the system that has this negative feedback loop, and the system needs to be changed. And people like myself, like all of the listeners, need to be given the options and choices that already exist. We're just not being told about them or given access to them.
Well, thank you so much, Candy Mossett. We've been speaking with Candy Mossett, an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. It sounds as though the hope that people placed in the peaceful resistance at Standing Rock, that hope is still alive.
Hope is alive. We never, ever, ever take our hope from us. And that's the most important and powerful thing that came out of Standing Rock. That fire that burned that whole time is still burning in all of our hearts. And it will continue to do so until we win.
Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. They're online at ienearth.org. Candy Mossett, thank you so much for joining us again on Counterspin.
Matsigirad, thank you.
Sinclair Broadcasting Group is already the largest owner of television stations around the country, with some 173. But it's looking to increase that dominance by taking over Tribune Media, which owns stations in key markets like New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. The deal would mean Sinclair would own more than 220 stations, reaching some 72% of U.S. TV households. Time was a single company controlling so much would raise alarms by itself, especially in a society that claims to value competition. But now, critics like Jack Schaefer say complaints about super-concentrated media ownership reek of stupidity, because after all, there's Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. No matter that vast numbers of Americans rely on local news as a primary way of learning about the world, or that the existence of multiple sectors is not an argument for a lack of diversity in one sector. It's as if to say, it's okay that school textbooks are biased, because after all, there are cookbooks and comic books, too. But if any company dominating the country's local news would be worrisome, those worries are compounded when it comes to Sinclair. Because of that company's pronounced ideological bent, their track record, and the means by which they appear to be getting their way. Here to fill us in on the situation is Craig Aaron. He's president of the group Free Press. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, perhaps before we talk about Sinclair becoming more powerful, we talk about what they've done with the power they already have. What should we know about this company?
Well, I think what you need to know about Sinclair is this is, first of all, a huge company. They already own more individual local television stations than any other company in the country. They're already at the supposed national cap for how many stations one company should be allowed to own. But Sinclair, in particular, has used their network to both push cookie-cutter content, but that content with a very, very conservative slant. This is a company with a very strong ideological agenda, and they push to all of their affiliates a series of conservative commentators who are must-runs for all those stations. They have to put them on the air. And they have a long history of using their media power to push a conservative agenda and especially a Republican Party agenda. You know, this goes back at least as far as their decision to run the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth video that was an attack, essentially a feature-length attack ad on John Kerry when he was running for president. And there are numerous instances since then where they have used the public airwaves to push a very, very partisan agenda.
Well, yeah, the familiar argument from some quarters is that Sinclair's in-your-face right-wing views actually represent an influx of diversity in media. That relies on a rarely examined assumption that all other media represent an equally staunch liberalism that needs countering, and then a never-explained assumption that liberalism means, you know, believing Muslims or gay people have human rights. Schaefer actually offers as an example of the kind of unique viewpoint that deserves amplification the fact that Sinclair made its ABC affiliates cancel Nightline when that show named the U.S. service people killed in the Iraq War. So we aren't talking about stations having roundtables in which conservatives have a voice. We're hearing about, as you intimate, about folks who are watching the local news that they've watched for years, and then what's that? Suddenly you're watching something called the Terrorism Alert Desk, you know, and it's talking about how France might ban Muslim women's bathing suits.
Right, exactly. This is what they've sort of specialized in, is this kind of fear-mongering coverage. Here come the graphics announcing Terrorism Alert Desk, but then strangely, the stories are just about Muslims, as if those were the same thing. This is a station that's been caught doctoring audio to make it sound like anti-police brutality protesters were chanting kill a cop when they were chanting, you know, put killer cops in jail. There's so many of these instances that have happened on Sinclair stations that they aren't anomalies. They are only offering one hard right slant in their commentary, which they mix in, of course, with your normal traffic and weather and car crashes and local government stories. But anytime it comes to covering national politics, national news, they are putting a very hard slant on that. Might be your local anchor sometimes reading the lead into a script, but very often you're getting centrally produced political programming pushing an agenda. And moreover, I think to Jack Schaefer's points, what I always recommend when you look at what these companies are doing is you look at what they actually tell their investors. And what Sinclair is saying is not, hey, look, we're going out there to offer an alternative viewpoint. What they're saying is we're going to try to take over as much local news as we can. And they are aggressively pursuing an agenda not only to reach more than 70% of the country they'll get if this deal goes through, but then to begin start swapping and trading stations at the local level so that they can operate 2, 3, 4 stations in a given market, benefit from all that shared back end and domination of advertising to actually push the same content out on multiple stations. This has long been their model. They've set up a bunch of shell companies to carry this out, but now under the Trump administration, they've sort of come out of hiding and pretending, and they're just going for it.
Well, let me ask you about that relationship to Trump, but I first wanted to say, yeah, the CEO of Sinclair, I understand, has been quoted saying, right now there are 3 to 5 local players, and to us that doesn't make sense. I mean, it seems an assault on localism per se before you even get to the ideological piece.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's their business agenda. And I think that is also what blows up all these arguments. But, oh, we have so many choices for media today. And that might be true in some senses around entertainment, but it's absolutely not true when it comes to local news. Still by far the number one source of news and information for people at the local level. And you've got one newsroom broadcasting on multiple stations. There's no one out there competing for stories. There's no diversity of viewpoints being put forward. That's incredibly damaging at that local level where it's needed the most.
Well, now, Sinclair is not just ideologically sharing a worldview with Donald Trump. The relationship goes rather deeper than that, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. You know, this is a company that is essentially producing Trump TV, at least in terms of the national programming and the must-runs. There are, of course, good journalists at all these local stations just trying to do their jobs and report what's happening in the local community, but it is interspersed with essentially Republican Party talking points. And, you know, after the election, Jared Kushner somewhat infamously acknowledged that he had a deal, as he called it, with Sinclair to offer sort of uncut access to the Sinclair airwaves for Trump. Sinclair will tell you, oh, we offered the same deal to Hillary Clinton, but strangely, only Donald Trump took them up on it. And they've gone out of their way to hire former Trump campaign folks like Boris Epstein, who is now their top political commentator, who essentially operates as an extension of the White House. So we have a situation where you've got a network absolutely going to bat for the Republican Party, taking it upon itself, using all the same talking points and language that Trump does on fake news to essentially offer an alternative narrative about what's actually happening in Washington, attacking other journalistic outlets for aggressively covering the president, saying the Russia stuff is no big deal, and on and on and on, trumpeting Trump, then turning around and saying, okay, we're here for our policy favors. We have a long wish list of limits on media ownership and other regulations that we'd like to get rid of, and the Trump administration actually making that a priority, either by loosening the rules or, in one case, actually reinstating a regulation the Obama administration got rid of in order to allow Sinclair to pretend its national reach, at least when they're at the FCC, to pretend that their national reach isn't as big as it actually is.
Now, I understand that even those who might be assumed to share their worldview are against this merger, other companies, and that's for different reasons. But still, you have other sort of what we might call right-wing outlets who themselves oppose the merger.
That's right. A number of groups filed formal challenges to the merger, including my group Free Press, but also Newsmax, some local newspaper publishers, Dish Television. But it's been interesting to see the critique coming from the right, which I think rightfully recognizes this is just too much media power in one company's hands. And they know that if Sinclair is allowed to have this dominance over local television, then they're going to use all of that money, all of that income to move into other markets. They have an online news service called Circa. Once they start making all this money from these big markets, from what's called retransmission consent negotiations, which allows cable companies to carry local broadcast stations, from all the political ads, they're going to pour that in to undercutting their competitors on the right, even where there's ideological alignment. And I think, you know, what you're seeing here, and you're seeing this on the right and the left right now, is just growing concern about too much media power, growing appreciation of just how seriously we need to get about antitrust and other limits on one company getting so big that others can no longer afford to compete. And that's one of the things that's at risk if a deal like this is allowed to go through, especially because what will happen is it will inspire other companies to do their own deals to try to catch up. So you're going to see the Nexstars and the Foxes of the world suddenly saying, oh, well, Sinclair's got 200 stations. Maybe we need 200 stations as well. And suddenly you have even fewer choices at the local level, and those few remaining independent stations are finding it really hard to compete against the scale that these behemoths can offer to advertisers and others.
Well, let me just ask you, if power buys voice, and this does look a lot like favor trading, you know, where does dissent get air, and how do we fight this, and can we continue to fight it even if the merger goes through?
Well, I think we're going to have to continue to fight it. The first step is to try to push back at the Federal Communications Commission, and public comment is still open, and people can go to freepress.net. I urge them to file comments letting the commission know about their concerns. But ultimately, this is a matter that Congress and others are going to have to look at. That's going to be one of the key ways to push back here as we look at what is it going to take. It doesn't feel like these conversations are possible in the era of Donald Trump, but they're the ones we need to start having now is, what is it going to take to break up some of these media behemoths? This is absolutely going in the wrong direction, and I think you see a lot of signs. All this concern on the right, you can look at what's happening in Democratic circles where suddenly antitrust is at the center of the platforms that they're putting out there. We need to start moving in that direction to stop just rubber stamping these deals and start demanding that we need more local choices, more local accountability, more support for public and independent alternatives, because if we just allow these guys to merge and merge and merge, we'll be stuck with the same cookie-cutter content wherever we go, and it's going to be very, very conservative, if not reactionary, if somebody doesn't step in.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron from the group Free Press. As he notes, you can find their work, including learning how to talk to the FCC on this merger, at freepress.net. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.